Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So let's begin. In his catechetical work on the Articles of Faith, Thomas Aquinas writes, Matrimony has a threefold good. The first is the birth of children and educating them to the worship of God. The second is that fidelity which one must render to another. And the third is that it is a sacrament, or in other words, the indivisibility of matrimony, which shows forth the indivisible union of Christ and his church. So we might more succinctly say that marriage has three goods: a procreative good, a unitive good, and a sacramental good. And so tonight I want to talk first about Thomas Aquinas' understanding of friendship and how it shapes his view of the unitive good of marriage. And then we'll discuss the procreative good, i.e. being fathers and mothers. And along the way, we can touch on the sacramental good of marriage. And if people want to talk more about that later, I'm happy to do that as well. And I'll then conclude with some practical steps that you can take now to prepare for marriage and children in the future, if that is something that you're interested in. So part one, marriage and friendship. Now, it's common, as you saw in the title, it's very common to the point of cliche to hear engaged couples or people who've just gotten married talk about how excited they are to marry their best friend, right? And other people say, well, we don't really want to talk too much about marrying your best friend, right? You want to make sure you have friendships outside of marriage. You can't put a lot of, you can't have the burden of being a best friend and a spouse on the shoulder of one poor person. Or they say, well, you know, there's no such thing as a soulmate. There's no such thing as that only one person that you could have married. And I take all those points. But nonetheless, in his discussion of the indissolubility of marriage in the Summa Quadri Gentiles, Thomas Aquinas writes, there seems to be the greatest friendship between husband and wife, for they are united not only in the act of fleshly union, which produces a certain general association even among beasts, but also in the partnership of the whole range of domestic activity. Friends share life together. And the fact that husbands and wives share their entire lives, right? Not just the fact that they have strong feelings for each other, the fact that they share their entire lives would seem to make them best friends. By examining Aquinas' understanding of friendship, which comes chiefly in his commentary on Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, I think we can gain insight into this connection he makes between strong friendships and strong marriages. Now, I understand that there are a lot of excellent philosophers here at the Universidad Panamericana. If you are one of them, I am about to give a very elementary review of Book 7 of the Nicomachean Ethics. So you can zone out, you know, look at the lights or something, because you will probably already know this. But also, I would also note at the very beginning, Aristotle would never have conceived of a husband and wife being friends, right? Those of you who remember your Aristotle will remember that. Friendship only happens between men who are equal, right? So for Aquinas to say husband and wife can have the greatest friendship is already kind of an interesting step that he takes. So we'll go back to Aristotle. In the Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle talks about friendship, and he starts by arguing that friendship is a good that everyone needs to pursue if they are going to live a happy life. And friendship, at least in its perfect form, is not an instrumental good. It's not something that we pursue so that we can get something else, right? So that we can get wealth, so that we can get power. Rather, we seek friendship because it's a participation in the life of another person. It's a sharing in the life of another person. And friendship, as Aquinas will capture it, is an exchange of love. It takes place in repeated acts of goodness from one friend to another, right? But we all know that this kind of of good is not present in all forms of friendship, right? We're all friends with someone for a reason, but we're all friends with someone maybe for different reasons, right? So Aristotle famously identifies three different kinds of friendship based on the three acts of love that could sort of seek an object in that friendship. So those are friendships for the good as such. That's kind of the true form of friendship, the one we'll talk most about. Friendship for the pleasurable and friendship for the useful. Okay, so if we translate these into practical terms, we could think of them as, well, being friends with someone because there's something good about them in and of themselves, something intrinsically good and delightful about a person. Or being friends with someone, well, because that person is really funny, or because that person's attractive or thrilling, right? Or being friends because someone can provide something useful for you, right? And in the second of these two, a person loves a friend for what is incidental, right? Or for something that is, to some degree, instrumental. So those are friendships by way of resemblance. They look like perfect friendship, but they aren't actually it. Those in that first category, people who are friends for the goods, are friends kind of essentially. You're friends for someone for who that person is in himself or in herself as a whole. And so therefore, only those who seek friendship for the sake of pursuing the good and with good people can know true friendship. This is Aristotle's claim. And Aristotle goes on to say, well, in a virtuous friendship like this, a virtuous person loves his friend because he is similar to himself, right? We love our friend as another self. We feel for our friend what we feel for ourselves. And a friendship like this begins in feelings of goodwill, right? We're kind of disposed in favor of someone based on their natural attributes. And the goodwill continues into friendship, and it's joined by acts of beneficence, which is just the fancy philosophical word for doing good things for somebody, right? And by a kind of concord or an agreement of mind and heart. And this is possible because the friends are alike in virtue. Their virtue impels them to make repeated acts of love. And because virtue is a permanent habit, these acts of love become a permanent, lasting friendship. Now, in addition to the joy of living with and knowing a kindred spirit, the virtuous person takes delight in friendship because it helps him become more virtuous in turn, right? Because of our natural affections for ourselves, you could say because of our bias, maybe in favor of ourselves, it's hard for us sometimes to judge our own actions well. And since we can't always study our own actions, since we can't judge our own actions well, we need someone who can be a kind of mirror, right? We need someone who's a kind of other self that we can love, that we can learn from. So two friends love what is good in each other. And through friendship, they become goods to each other. Each wishes the good for the other's sake and not his own. And this mutual love, Aquinas will argue, makes friendship something that's even above a virtue, because he says the act of one is not sufficient, but the act of two, mutually loving one another, must concur. So friendship is not only a matter of pursuing kind of your own goodness, your own virtue, but allowing and helping and wanting somebody else to become better too. So if this is the structure of a good friendship for Aristotle and for Aquinas, let me suggest four ways in which the sharing of life between a husband and wife can make marriage the greatest friendship. So first, a good marriage is founded on the good that spouses perceive in each other. It allows spouses to delight in each other, to rejoice in each other's good, to rejoice in the mutual enjoyment of the good that they share. So if I assume most of you do not yet have a spouse, that you're more at the stage of life where you're looking for one. So if you're looking for a spouse, don't just think about whether or not they fit kind of your type or what your idea for what a girl or what a guy should be, right? It's good to date people who are cute, right? It's good to date people who are nice or who are good at sports or whatever, right? But think about what makes that person deeply good. Think about whether what makes her really good can help make you a better man, and vice versa. Two, a good marriage begins with feelings of goodwill and attraction, and it's then joined to beneficence, doing good things for each other, and an agreement, a concord of mind and heart. And marriage entails doing and willing the good for your spouse constantly, even when you don't feel like it, and making your spouse's good your own. And a good marriage requires and enables enough agreement between spouses so that they can live together in peace, even if they don't agree on everything about religion or politics or other things in life, even if they don't root for the same sports team. You know, that might be a difficulty. If you have a Red Sox fan married to a Yankees fan, right? That you have to have other things that you agree on that to keep the peace, right? A good marriage, number three, a good marriage can help you become more virtuous. And this is both joyful and it's extremely difficult. In my experience, more than anything else in life, marriage and children show you just how self-centered you are. And they train you to become centered on somebody else and on somebody else's good. And for Christians, marriage is the path to sanctity that God has prepared for the spouses. And sanctity and virtue, as difficult as they are, they allow us to flourish. They allow us to more perfectly live a life animated by God's love. And even if there are difficulties, they allow us to actually be more happy, to live a richer and more full life. So four, a good marriage entails building and sharing a good life with another person, both the diverse goods that we enjoy in this life and ultimately our enjoyment of goodness itself, right? Life with God in the next life. So to put it another way, maybe Christian marriage is a shared pilgrimage to life with God in heaven, and that ultimate goal can help spouses keep in perspective the joys and the sorrows that they experience. Now, in the Summa Theologiae, which is Thomas Aquinas' famous work of theology, there are three parts, and then he died while finishing the third part. Well, he stopped writing before he died, but we'll leave that aside. And there are some of you who will know that story, I'm sure. And so after his death, his students kind of compiled what's called the supplement to the Summa, where they took his other writings and they tried to finish the Summa as they think Thomas would have finished it. So in the supplement compiled by his students, Aquinas shows how grace builds upon and expands the friendship of marriage in making this natural union between husband and wife into a sacrament. And Aquinas considers the argument that marriage is not a sacrament because the sacraments derive their efficacy from Christ's passion. And this argument would go, well, look, since marriage involves sexual pleasure, it doesn't conform us to Christ's passion because that was painful. Now, Aquinas does not agree with this argument. And he says in reply, although matrimony is not conformed to Christ's passion as regards pain, it is as regards charity, whereby he suffered for the church who was to be united to him as his spouse. And this is one of those moments that can happen, for me at least, when you read Thomas Aquinas, where his writing is kind of like a prism that refracts a ray of light into many different colors. Or it's like you're reading him, and all of a sudden you've walked through the door of a cathedral into this kind of vast space, right? I think here Aquinas is saying he has a beautiful idea. In marriage, the spouses give themselves to each other and they lay down their lives for each other totally, just as Christ did for the church on the cross. And so it's that total and faithful gift of themselves that allows the sacramental marriage of a husband and wife to be an image of Christ's gift of himself for the church. Now, I think there are three things that follow from this. First, the married couple's own self-gift becomes the path by which they imitate Christ and become Christ-like. Second, in the sacrament of marriage, God gives us his love so that we can love others as he does, so that we can love with his love. And third, marriage is also the place in which we should receive God's love through the self-gift of our spouse. So in a good marriage, something beautiful can happen where God shows us what his love looks like by how our spouse loves us. Now, conceived in this way, I think it makes sense for someone to say that he's married his best friend, right? The friendship of husband and wife is founded on an attraction or thrill, but that thrill, that attraction, they have their roots in the goodness of the other spouse. And that friendship should grow in a series of actions that make both spouses better, that cement their delight in each other's good, in a life of mutual beneficence and sacrifice. And then empowered by grace, their marriage becomes an icon of God's love, however imperfectly, and a means of their growth in that love toward its full flowering in the beatific vision. So we could add to Aquinas that not only is marriage conformed to Christ's passion as regards to charity, but I would argue it's also conformed to Christ's resurrection, right? Marriage can be healing and transformative. It can give joy now and in the life to come. And this description of friendship and marriage is something that has kind of mapped onto my own life as well. My wife and I spent time thinking about the religious life. We had met once in the past, but we got to know each other when we were both in graduate school and when we were living near each other with mutual friends. And then one day, I'm not even sure that you could say that we were that good friends yet. So early in our friendship, I borrowed her car. And it turns out that you learn a lot about someone if you crash her car. I understand that car crashes happen fairly frequently in Mexico City. I don't recommend finding a spouse by crashing her car, right? But it worked for me. So, you know, I don't know. But after misreading a traffic light at a terrible intersection on a rainy night, I came back to Jane's house. And I discovered that she was concerned more for my well-being than for the well-being of her front bumper. And I discovered that she was very kind. She was very calm. And I was struck by the mercy that she showed me. Now, it took time and prayer for clarity to emerge about my desire for Jane, about my desire to have children. And it also became clear to me that that was a clarity about how I desired to love and how God had formed me to love. So Jane and I had been friends for a year when I asked her out on a date to see if there was more there. And as I was telling Issa earlier, we had already had a conversation where we said, no, we're just very good friends. We're all very nice friends. That's great. And so I had to come back and I had to say, well, I'd like to revisit that conversation that we had. And I took her on a picnic in the public garden in downtown Boston. And as we sat there, it sounds kind of weird to say, and if you feel like you don't understand, it's not a translation error, it's just weird to say. It felt to me like I was kind of plunging into an ocean of mercy, which is something that I still can't fully fathom, but I found no better way to describe. And so 8 months later after that date, we were engaged, we were married a year after that, and I think that that willingness to be merciful with each other, to bear with each other's weaknesses and faults, has proved to be one of the strengths of our marriage. So Jane and I, in just a couple of months, are going to celebrate our 10th anniversary. And we now have three sons, John, George, and Hugh. When we first told the Spanish sisters that run our school that our son was named Hugh, they said, "Who? What?" And I said, no, Hugo. And they said, oh, okay, Hugo. But I was also told, no, it's just Hugh Jackman. So maybe, I guess the Spanish nuns don't know who Hugh Jackman is, but you all do. So Hugh is not a name that's going to be a problem. So let me offer some reflections now on what we've come to learn about being parents. And the reflections are really two. And the first one seems pretty obvious, but I think there's more to unpack. And the second one was to me a surprise that I only discovered when I read Aquinas. So the first one is that fatherhood and motherhood are about generation, about the creation of new life. And the second is that fatherhood and motherhood are about priesthood. Okay, so we'll start with generation. In the Summa, early in the first part of the Summa, question 33, when Thomas is talking about the Trinity, he asks, okay, what makes God the Father? Why is this person of the Trinity called the Father? And Thomas writes, the proper name of any person signifies that whereby the person is distinguished from all other persons. Now it is paternity which distinguishes the person of the Father from all other persons. Hence this name Father, whereby paternity is signified, is the proper name of the person of the Father. And Thomas also says that the heart of that paternity is the Father being the principle for, or the source of, the one who generates the other persons of the Trinity, the Son and the Holy Spirit. And Aquinas goes on to argue that because the Father and the Son are ontologically one, that means that they're one in being, even if we can distinguish between two persons, they manifest perfectly the idea of paternity and the idea of filiation, right? The creation of a son. And here he's echoing Paul's letter to the Ephesians, Ephesians 3, 14 to 15. And Paul says, for this reason, I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth takes its name. And in the Latin Vulgate, the Latin version of the Bible that Aquinas would have used, the word that I've just said as family is actually paternitas, which means fatherhood. And in Greek, it's patria, which can mean both family and fatherhood. So the point is that our fatherhood and our motherhood have a share in God's fatherhood. And God's fatherhood is grounded in giving the other persons of the Trinity their being. And we see this kind of dynamic in Genesis 1 in the creation of the world as well, right? There's a great Dominican preacher from what are now the Netherlands named Meister Eckhart, and he talks about creation as though like there's a pot on a stove that's boiling over. He uses the Latin word ebullitio. So it's like the love of God is so powerful, it's so potent that it just bubbles over, you know, like a pot that you forgot about when you were cooking. And this generation of the Son and the Spirit, so this eternal generation of the Son and the Spirit, the love and the relationship they share, it boils over into the generation of other beings that can participate in but be distinct from divine being. So we human beings are made in the image and likeness of God, and it's not a coincidence that God's first command to Adam and Eve is to be fruitful and multiply. An important part of our being made in the image and likeness of God is our capacity to generate new life. And to generate new life, not just sort of, you know, through a physical act, but out of a union of love, right? So to put it more succinctly, God made men and women to beget new life, to bring about new life, and thereby to share in his fatherhood. And I know that we're here at a Catholic university. I did not go for my undergraduate studies to a Catholic university. I went to a secular university. So I want to underscore this because I find it to be radically different from our dominant culture, at least in the U.S. You can correct me if, you can tell me later if this is true in Mexico as well. Because this vision of the goodness of our capacity to generate life is very different. So I vividly remember a girl in my residence hall who had a poster for Planned Parenthood on the wall. And it had rows of condoms in all the colors of the rainbow, and they were cascading down. And underneath it, it said, "Life is sexually transmitted," which is not just a statement of the obvious, but a clear implication that human life is kind of like a disease, right? We don't, you know, for the same reasons that you would use a condom to prevent disease, you kind of also use it to prevent human life, right? That's a vastly different picture of human life, the goodness of life, the goodness of our capacity to create it, than what we have in Scripture and what we have in our faith. Scripture and our faith teach us that our capacity for generating new life is good, that it's a gift. Yes, it's a gift to handle with care, a gift to handle with prudence, but it's an important part of our being like God. It's something that's constitutive of our humanity. It's not a mistake. It's not a disease. It's not something that we can unplug, that we can thwart, that we can ignore without consequence. So in his apostolic exhortation, Familiaris Consortio, St. John Paul II, along these lines, writes, "According to the plan of God, marriage is the foundation of the wider community of the family, since the very institution of marriage and conjugal love are ordained to the procreation and education of children in whom they find their crowning." What a beautiful image, that children are the crowning of the union of husband and wife. "In its most profound reality," St. John Paul II continues, "love is essentially a gift, and conjugal love, while leading the spouses to the reciprocal knowledge which makes them one flesh, does not end with the couple, because it makes them capable of the greatest possible gift, the gift by which they become cooperators with God for giving life to a new human person." And St. John Paul II goes on to underscore another important aspect of fatherhood in particular. And he says, well, since human fatherhood takes its name from God's fatherhood, the love of parents, and he says, especially the love of a father, becomes a visible sign of the love of God. In other words, a good father shows his wife and his children what God's love looks like, which is a terribly high but beautiful responsibility. And as John Paul II will put it later in that same letter, a father reveals and relives on earth the very fatherhood of God. So that brings me to the second characteristic of fatherhood, which is also a characteristic of motherhood, that they're about priesthood. Now, obviously, I don't mean that, you know, all fathers and mothers are priests, just like an ordained priest who says Mass, right? I mean that this in the sense that we are all called and empowered to participate in the priesthood of Christ by our baptism, and those of us in the lay life have been called to sanctify the world through our acts of charity and preaching of the gospel. And this emphasis on the work of the laity is one of the great contributions of the Second Vatican Council, right? It's something that if you ever learned about Vatican II in school, you probably learned that the importance of the laity is something that is kind of, it's like a hallmark. It's one of the main themes. But already, I was delighted to find out, in the Summa Contra Gentiles, we find Thomas Aquinas reflecting on how fathers and mothers are called to participate in the priestly work of Christ. So in the beginning of his discussion of the sacraments, in book 4 of the Summa Contra Gentiles, Thomas writes, "For some propagate and conserve the spiritual life in an only spiritual ministry." And this belongs to the sacrament of holy orders, i.e. priests. "And some in a ministry that is simultaneously bodily and spiritual, which takes place in the sacrament of matrimony, where a man and a woman come together to beget offspring and rear them in divine worship." So here Thomas clearly distinguishes between the work of a spiritual father in the ordained priesthood and the work of a natural father while identifying them both as priestly work, right? Which is work that sanctifies the world, work that offers it to God and that brings souls to him. So it's very important for Thomas that fatherhood and motherhood are not just about having children, right? He's in favor of having children. That's good. But it's about forming those children so that their lives are directed toward the worship of God, so that their lives are correctly oriented toward their ultimate human purpose, right? Which is the love of God now and in the life to come. And in this regard, St. John Paul II underlines the importance of family prayer. And he says, the concrete example and living witness of parents is fundamental and irreplaceable in educating their children to pray. Only by praying together with their children can a father and mother exercising their royal priesthood, note that concept that he's getting from Aquinas there, penetrate the innermost depths of their children's hearts and leave an impression that the future events in their lives will not be able to efface. And if you know anything about the life of John Paul II and the importance that his father and mother and their faith, their example, had for him, I imagine that he's very much thinking of his own life here. Now, this sounds beautiful in theory, but as those of you who grew up in a Catholic family know, and as those of you, or at least those of us here who are parents know, this can be very messy. At least in my family, we have three boys, right? So you can imagine that sitting still is not a skill that we have yet. It's something we're working on, right? Our family rosary involves trying to sort of clutch at a moment of recollection at something like a prayer that I might be able to generate between endless questions about what bead we're on, constantly having to tell people to stop swinging the rosary, stop putting your feet on the rosary, sit down, try to pretend like we're praying, etc., right? And on top of this, you know, it sounds like I'm just blaming the children, but I'm part of the problem too. I lead the family rosary. I cannot keep track of what set of mysteries we are on. I cannot keep track of which mystery we're on. So, you know, I might try to follow, be like the second glorious mystery. And then the next one, I'll be like the third sorrowful mystery. And my wife says, no, we're on the glorious mystery. Stop. So what I'm trying to say is that you know, this can be a little messy. And I discussed this once with my pastor, who reminded me of one of the great sayings from sports: a messy win is still a win. And so I think prayer and many other aspects of family life are kind of like this, right? In a family, you want to take the messy wins when you can. And you hope that a foundation of real love and real devotion is nonetheless being laid down. So as you know, one of the defining characteristics of a priest in most religions is that a priest offers sacrifices. And the priesthood of a father and mother entails offering sacrifices constantly for the sake of your spouse, for the sake of the children. So the vocation of fatherhood or motherhood, when lived well, it's a kind of ascetic vocation, right? It's a vocation where you learn to put the needs of others before your own, to choose their good instead of your benefit or pleasure. And when he's reflecting on this, John Paul II writes, spouses are therefore a permanent reminder to the church of what happened on the cross. They are for one another and for the children witnesses to the salvation in which the sacrament makes them sharers. And note again that connection back to what Aquinas had said earlier about marriage being conformed to Christ's passion by charity. Now, in the Gospel of John, as Jesus approaches the Last Supper, as he approaches his passion, he tells his disciples, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. He who loves his life loses it, and he who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life." So notice that this passage begins with Jesus saying that he will be glorified. And that theme of glory is one of the most important themes running through the whole Gospel of John. And Jesus is glorified. The Gospel of John culminates in Jesus being glorified. But how is he glorified? He's glorified in his death on the cross. He's glorified in the act, in this act by which the glory of God is revealed as self-emptying, self-sacrificial love that's poured out for us. So there's a paradox in Jesus' painful, shameful death, which is the farthest thing from glory that the world could conceive, especially the classical world in which John is writing. In that death, that's what actually reveals God's glory most fully. So if we tie this back to our main theme, we could say that for those who are called to them, marriage and fatherhood or motherhood are the form of Christian life by which we are going to spend ourselves, by which we're going to give ourselves away. They're the way by which we deny ourselves, take up our cross, and follow Christ. The way by which we lose our lives for Christ's sake and thereby keep them for eternal life. They're the path of sacrifice that we choose by which we love others, by which we receive their love and God's, by which we're conformed to Christ's passion as regards to charity, as we heard Aquinas say. And it's this that reveals the glory of God, first, we hope, to our immediate family, and from there on, to the world. And for me, marriage has been a school of self-gift like this. And it showed me how I need to sacrifice my desires and my plans for the sake of my wife and children. It showed me that this is how you follow Jesus' command to lose your life so that you might find it in him. That this is the way by which you enter into joys that you didn't know exist on the far side of burdens you didn't know that you could bear. And so for this, for those called to marriage, this is the path by which Christ calls us to share in his fatherhood, to share in his priesthood, for the salvation of our own souls and the souls of our spouses and our children. Okay, so we've had some higher theology. We've had some stories from my own life. Now we're going to end with some practical tips. So if you like the sound of this vision of marriage and family life, and you think that God might be calling you to it, here are some practical steps you can take. This one is directed to the men in the room, and it's very simple. Ask her out. Now, I am told that young Catholics in Mexico are right now not having the same problems with this simple piece of advice that young Catholics in the States are having. Good for you. But the principle still holds. If you find a girl attractive, if you want to get to know her better, take her out for a meal, right? And this principle also works if you're thinking about the religious life or the priesthood, right? If there's a community, a religious community, that you think has a beautiful form of life, and there's something about that that draws you, just go visit them, right? When you take someone out for dinner, you're not saying you want to marry her, right? You're just saying that you want to get to know her better. You want to talk to her more. In the same way, if you go on a retreat with a religious community, you're not signing your life away. You're just getting to know them better. So get to know people better. Number two, as you get to know someone better, once you've asked them out, if I didn't mention that already, think about what it would be like to share life with that person and to have a family with them. The founder of the Thomistic Institute, Father Thomas Joseph White, who's now the president, only he has a better title. He's the Rector Magnificus of the Angelicum in Rome. He once gave me three good pieces of advice to help think about this. He said, in my experience, healthy marriages have three components. First, the spouses are physically attracted to each other. Second, the spouses share enough beliefs in common that they can really build a life together. And third, the spouses can rest in each other. So ask yourself questions like, am I physically attracted to this person? Can she help me become a holier person? Can she help me love God more? Do I want her to be the mother of my children? Can we spend a lot of time together and be at peace? When my wife and I were engaged, one of my aunts died, and I was with her when she died, and I realized that the person who I wanted with me when I died was my wife, right? So this is not a question for the first date. This is a question for like months and months in, right? But like, think about it. Someday you're gonna die. Do you want this person there with you then? 3, read about the lives of married saints. And this can help us understand what outstanding holiness looks like within the married life. And spend time with married couples and families that you admire. It was very important, especially to my wife, for her to see what married saints looked like, or what married, you could say, saints in the making looked like. And that helped her figure out what she wanted in a spouse and in a home. So we had a piece of advice for the guys, piece of advice for the girls. If you're a woman, consider looking into methods to monitor your fertility. Now, this is obviously something that's useful in marriage, right? When couples may practice natural family planning. But even before this, knowing how your body works is good for you, and it can help solve other health issues in your life that you may experience. But it's definitely useful if you're thinking that you're going to go into a Catholic marriage. 5, make chastity a priority as a single person and in your relationships. And I don't know about here, but in the States, chastity can be frequently seen as sort of like a bunch of rules, right? Or it's like those invisible dog collars they have for the dog, where like if the dog goes too far, it kind of gets a shock, right? And you're kind of like, how far can I go before I sort of get the shock of sin or something like that? Well, a better way to think about chastity is to think of it as a question of freedom, right? We are freer. We are more satisfied when we try to relate to others without trying to possess them, when we appreciate beauty and excellence without needing to grasp it for ourselves. And so in this sense, chastity isn't a set of rules. It's not a set of sort of yeses or nos or lines in the sand. It's an integration of our senses, an integration of our mind, our intellectual powers, and our actions. It's getting everything lined up so that we are pursuing our ultimate goal, our ultimate happiness, right? And it's ordering the rest of our life in that direction. This view that I've articulated is fleshed out very nicely in a book by a Norwegian bishop named Erik Vardan, which in English is called Chastity, and I'm sure its title is very similar in Spanish. I would expect that there's a Spanish translation. If not now, then there will be very soon. It's a very good book, and I recommend it. 6, marriage is a beautiful opportunity to live in mercy with each other. So if there are sins or struggles from your past that you're ashamed of, if there are things that you didn't like about your parents' marriage or about your own upbringing, the good news with marriage is that you can begin again. Those don't have to follow you into your marriage. But whether you're destined for the married life or for the consecrated life in some form, I would recommend beginning to address these things now, right? Pray about them in the Mass. Bring them to confession. Talk to a priest about them. Talk to a psychologist about them. That will allow you to kind of prepare now to make a fuller gift of yourself when you say yes to your vocation eventually. And then finally, the final piece of advice is to just keep the foundation of your life based on Christ, right? Marriage and family life are ultimately a path to Christ, a preparation for loving God forever in heaven, and hopefully helping to bring your spouse and your children along with you. So thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.